Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. We do our This Day in History before we jump into the meat of our program. That was the sound of Ahmad Jamal, whose birthday is today. And happy birthday, Ahmad Jamal, one of the people who actually turned me on to jazz as a very young man. And we'll be playing his songs all during the course of the hour, because he was a very special human being who took on the Muslim religion very early, before many people did in this country, changed his name, inspired many with his work, inspired many with his spirituality, his sense of politics and fairness, and of course his incredible work as a jazz musician. This is also the birthday, oddly enough, three of the, I think, of some of the most important men, for different reasons, of last century, were born today. In 1908, Thurgood Marshall was born, who was the predecessor of our guest, Sherrilyn Ifill, first African-American Supreme Court Justice, who was a fighter for justice and civil rights his entire life, from Baltimore. And we've done many shows, which we will link to on our website, on the life of Thurgood Marshall. And today was his birthday. He was born in 1908. This is also the day that Medgar Evers was born. Just recently we did a program about the assassination and murder of Medgar Evers, but those who were close to him knew him and worked with him. And he was also born on this day. Another great fighter for liberty and liberation was born on this day, Patrice Lumumba. Many of you may not know that name, but he was the first prime minister of the Democratic Republic of the Congo. He was killed in 1961, assassinated, murdered with the help of the United States of America and the CIA. He was one of the great leaders of the fight to end African colonialism in Africa, and he was killed in 1931, was born on this day in 1925. This is also the birthday of one of the great playwrights in our world, Edward Bullens, who was born in 1935. And on this day, on July 2nd, 1828, the first African-American Catholic order of nuns was founded here in Baltimore. The Oblate Sisters of Providence were established on July 2nd. There were women from Cuba, Haiti, the United States, who came together and created this order here in Baltimore. Baltimore being one of the two great centers of African American Catholicism, along with New Orleans, and later this month we'll be talking with the new Secretary General of that order. She'll be coming on the program to talk about the Oblate Sisters and the history and the future of that, with the petition to have the founder of that order be given sainthood. So we'll be talking about that in the coming month as well. This was also the day that Denmark Vesey was murdered. He was executed when he was led one of the largest slave revolts in America. It would have been one of the largest slave revolts in America in 1822. He was betrayed by some of his own fellows and was caught and executed. So that happened on this day in history in 1822. This is also, given what we're about to talk about, in 1964, President Lyndon Johnson signed the Civil Rights Act of 1964 to prohibit segregation in public places. And I think that's a fine way for us to begin this conversation we're about to start with here on the show. We are joined here on the air by Sherrilyn Ifill, who has been a guest on the show many times, but now she is president and director counsel of the NAACP Legal Defense Fund. And Sherrilyn, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thanks, Mark. I'm so happy to be on.
And folks, join us here at 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. Log on to our Facebook pages or tweet us at Mark Steiner, 410-319-8888. I remember, Sherrilyn, reading the piece you wrote about affirmative action before the decision was made.
Mm-hmm.
It struck me as almost prescient in kind of the tone of what you wrote, kind of feeling what was about to come. I'm curious what you think that decision means for the future. I saw the piece you wrote after that, and other people in this program argued that the way this opinion was written would actually make it harder for affirmative action because of the hurdles it would now have to go through to become an effective tool in universities and colleges.
Well, Mark, let me go back for a second and just say, first of all, you just blew me away with this day in history. I've got to tell you. Pretty amazing. I wrote the piece that appeared in the New York Times because I felt pretty strongly that over the past 4 or 5 months, the Times and other publications had given thousands of words of ink to writers, including some on the Times staff, who to me, had already determined that we were losing the affirmative action case in the Supreme Court. It decided that race was no longer relevant in affirmative action and we should only be focused on class. Now, I actually believe pretty strongly that we do have to work affirmative action more effectively to ensure that we are capturing African Americans from the margins and from the bottom. So I'm fully on board with the class piece, but I am on board with the intersection of race and class. And the idea that so many writers were, and many of these writers were kind of liberals, or so-called liberals, who were appearing to jettison the whole idea that race has any significance for purposes of affirmative action. And I found it quite shocking. I mean, well, first of all, I'm a lawyer. I'm not in the habit of throwing my case before it's even decided, so that was irritating. But it was. There also seemed to be this kind of consensus among academics, intellectuals, and you know, and the media. So I wanted to write this piece, and we were largely silent. You know, there wasn't a lot of counter. Actually, there really wasn't any. There weren't any pieces that appeared to say, "Hey, wait a minute, race still matters." So I knew that it was a week before the decision was likely to come down because, you know, we were a week out of, before the end of the Supreme Court term. And, you know, to be honest, I wasn't sure what the court was going to do. I had a feeling that the court was not going to jettison race and affirmative action, in part because I had reread a concurrence that Justice Kennedy wrote in a case called Parents Involved, involving voluntary desegregation in Seattle. It was a terrible decision that he was concurring in, but his concurrence offered a kind of very strong and robust support of the ongoing relevance and use of race in affirmative action. And he wrote that in 2006. And I just, the more I read it, I thought, there's just no way he's going to throw the whole thing over. But that wasn't, the, you know, I didn't, whatever the outcome of the case, I wanted to speak to those people who had decided themselves and appeared to be, I thought, trying to almost prepare the soil to make it acceptable for the Supreme Court to do something that would have been radical, which is to overturn, you know, essentially 30 years of jurisprudence in which the court had supported the relevance of race in affirmative action. And I thought, you know, that making this change kind of in our conversation about race was a little bit disturbing and subversive. So that's why I wrote the piece.
So one of the things you said, and that I think is really important to explore just for a moment before we move on to the Voting Rights Act, which I'm very disturbed about and want to talk about with you, is you use the word, it's important to address the intersection of race and class. The argument is really not been about that for most people. How we kind of, and I like to hear how you define that intersection for the 21st century, because people are talking about replacing consideration of race with consideration for class.
Right.
Those are two very different concepts.
Yeah, because, I mean, I also think that universities ought to be reaching out to poor and low-income white kids, don't get me wrong. But, you know, my focus, Mark, as you probably know, is I'm most interested in those who are most marginalized, you know, and that is at the corner of race and class. And until we reach that piece, we're not really giving a chance to those who are most at the edge. And I am not letting go of the significance of race. I mean, let me give you an example, right? Part of what I tried to talk about in the piece, and, you know, I had to cut it down considerably, so a lot of it ended up on the cutting room floor. But, you know, particularly for state schools, right? Forget about Harvard and Yale and you know, private schools in affirmative action. I'm talking about public institutions. Take University of Maryland, University of Texas, University of Florida. You know, I had one of our terrific paralegals at LDF, you know, do a little study for me. And what you find is that the vast majority of, you know, judges, 100% of appellate judges in Alabama came through the University of Alabama system, right? 70% of, you know, judges in Maryland, 70% of the legislature in Florida, right? You know, the leaders of the state come through the university system. And those leaders need themselves to, reflect the society that they are about to lead, but they also need to understand all the different elements of the society. They need to be, the university is the place where we send our young people to develop them as leaders. And so we need to make sure that space includes young people from all different walks of life who we expect to be the leaders of the state in 10 and 20 years. And we need to make sure that in that space they have an opportunity to interact with one another so that their leadership will be informed by understanding the different experiences of the people in their own communities. So if you're in Texas, it not only explains why you want to make sure that you have Latinos at the University of Texas, but it also explains why you want to have Latinos who are from the Rio Grande and Valley and Latinos who are from the city in Houston, right? It explains why you, even within diversity, want to have diversity, right? It explains why you actually want students to understand that not all black people are poor, so you want to have black middle-class students. And you also want to have, you know, black students who are of Caribbean heritage and black students who are of African heritage and black students who are of African-American heritage. But if we're talking about diversity, we're talking about really making sure that students understand, you know, the environment in which they live. And then, of course, although the Supreme Court has let it go, we have never let go of the belief that given the history of this country and the history of racial exclusion and discrimination, that it's important for African-Americans to have this opportunity, who for generations were shut out of these institutions and therefore, you know, only recently can take advantage of children of alumni affirmative action, right?
Right, right.
You know, that we continue to believe that that's important.
So so what does it leave the struggle for that now? I mean, is so, part of the struggle extra legal or is it all legal?
So you know, what the court said essentially was they didn't change essentially the decision in the Grutter case that in 2003 said that you could use race as a factor in affirmative action for college admissions. But it did say that courts reviewing the plan of states have to be more rigorous in making sure that there was no race-neutral alternative that the university could have used. Listen, affirmative action has been pared down considerably. But, you know, universities have found ways to comply with the law, you know, and to meet their needs, right? And so, and I actually think that University of Texas, the case was sent back to the lower court, that University of Texas will be able to do that, because what University of Texas argued is we don't want just diversity in the whole school. We want diversity in the classroom, right? And what they discovered was the race-neutral plan they used, the top 10% plan, which meant any
right.
high school student graduating in the top 10% of their public high school would be admitted to the University of Texas. And it did increase diversity somewhat, but not quite enough. And, of course, it increased diversity only because of the fact that Texas is, like so many states, so residentially segregated. So they knew they would have black students and Latino students in the top 10% because they would be the black school and the Latino school just like we have here, right? If we had a top 10% plan in Maryland, you would get some students who graduated in the top 10% of their class from Baltimore City, and they'd be black, right? Just because
correct.
Our
right,
schools,
right.
They'd be admitted along with the top 10% of students from Montgomery County and Carroll County and all of that, right? Now, an unexplored issue is the different preparation level of those students, right? Given the kind of resources and the inequity in resources between suburban schools, public schools, and city public schools, and so forth. And that's a whole other issue, whether once they get in, they are equally prepared to deal with the rigors of college. But that's the plan that Texas had. But what Texas discovered is it still didn't yield enough diversity for diversity in the classroom. And so they discovered that in 80% of their classes, there was only one or no black students. And so for that reason, they decided to use that top 10% plan for 75% of their admissions, and then for 25%, they used a more holistic review of the student applications to try and increase all kinds of diversity.
Now, while the affirmative action issue is huge and was really troubling, at least for me, reading what happened and where this may be coming to in America, the Voting Rights Bill,
yes.
The Voting Rights Act, I should say, what happened there was could have huge political ramifications in this country.
It's already having huge political ramifications. It was only hours after the Supreme Court issued its decision last week that the Attorney General of Texas was not just writing it, but tweeting his intention to impose Texas's voter ID law, which was regarded as the most onerous in the country. Texas had the voter ID law that does not allow students to use their student ID, but does allow you to use your concealed weapon permit as ID for voting. And we at the NAACP Legal Defense Fund represented students who had been using their student ID in the past and now by this law would not be able to use it. But it was within hours. I went to the White House for a meeting with the Attorney General a few hours after the decision came out, and the Attorney General of Texas had already tweeted, "We intend to impose that law immediately." That law had been challenged and actually was pending in the Supreme Court, awaiting that decision. And then a series of other states did the same thing. And actually, if you go on my Twitter handle, it's S-Eiffel underscore LDF, S-I-S like Sam, I-F-I-L-L underscore LDF, I actually tweeted yesterday a link to our website that lays out, we've compiled all the quotes, all the statements of the different Southern officials about what they're going to do now that this decision has come down.
I mean, what this could mean is, I mean, if Shelby, Alabama was the case that started this in the Supreme Court, I mean, it was in their very city of Calera where it was the center of this when they districted out the black councilman that they had.
Yep.
And they'll probably redo that, and you could probably see this stumbling through Mississippi, where all the Democrats in the state legislature are African American, could be redistricted out of their seats. I mean, you could see this. I can see this kind of really having a tumbling effect around the entire country.
I have said, Mark, and I stand by this. I believe this is a game changer. I believe this is ushering in the largest shift in Democratic participation we've seen in this country in a generation, if not several. For those who don't know what happened, Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act is a provision of the act that requires certain jurisdictions who are set out in Section 4 of the act to submit to the Attorney General, to the Department of Justice, or to a federal district court any voting changes that they want to make in their jurisdiction to determine whether those voting changes would discriminate against minority voters. This was created by Congress because they wanted to get ahead of what they called the ingenious methods of Southern jurisdictions to disenfranchise black voters. They said, we basically can't keep up. We can't stay ahead of all of the changes they make. And so what we'll do is we'll put the onus on the jurisdiction to demonstrate that whatever changes they want to make don't negatively affect the African-American community. And Congress also wanted to take the burden off what they call the victim of discrimination and put it on the perpetrators, the jurisdictions. Why should the victim have to sue after a discriminatory voting change has happened, spend all the money, spend years in court? Instead, we'll use a cheap administrative process where all the jurisdiction has to do is describe the change they want to make, put it in an envelope and pay for a stamp and send it to the Department of Justice. And then the Department of Justice asks them a series of questions and gets in touch with local minority community groups to make sure that the change does not have a negative effect. And that's been going on for 48 years. The jurisdictions are mostly in the South, but they also include three boroughs in New York. They include Alaska. They included parts of New Hampshire until very recently, some counties in California, Arizona. Because many of these jurisdictions also came under this provision once in 1975. The Voting Rights Act also added its protection of language minorities. That's how the three boroughs in New York got in. That's how the state of Texas actually came under the Voting Rights Act. And so the Supreme Court essentially, that particular provision has been reauthorized by Congress. It's been upheld by the Supreme Court. It was challenged. This passed in 1965. It was challenged in 1966, and in a case called South Carolina versus Katzenbach, the Supreme Court said Congress has the power to do this. Where did they get the power from? The 15th Amendment. 15th Amendment was the last of the three Civil War amendments. 15th Amendment outlaws discrimination in voting based on race, color, national origin. And in it, Section 2 of the 15th Amendment, Congress has the power to enforce that provision. So there's no interpretation about that. It is Congress's power. So it was challenged immediately. Supreme Court upheld it under Congress's authority under the 15th Amendment. It has been reauthorized several times. It has always been upheld every time it's been reauthorized. It was reauthorized most recently in 2006. In 2006, Congress spent a year looking at the jurisdictions that were under Section 5, within that section 4B of the statute, they looked at voting discrimination that was taking place in those jurisdictions between 1982 and 2006. They found there was still voting discrimination. They extended it. It was almost unanimous. It was bipartisan, 98-0 in the Senate. Not one United States senator voted against it, including senators from all the southern states and other states that are covered by this formula, and 390-33 in the House.
Wow.
This is 2006, signed by George W. Bush.
So not,
and the United States Supreme Court, because they believe that America has changed, and this is a stigma on the South, even though all the jurisdictions that are covered are not in the South, but that this is a stigma on the South, and that they believe Congress acted irrationally. Now it's Congress that did the year's worth of hearings, amassed a 15,000-page record, heard from 52 witnesses, but Congress, says the Supreme Court, acted irrationally, and the Supreme Court, in one fell swoop, threw out a protection that had covered minority voters in these jurisdictions for 48 years.
And we only have a couple minutes left before you have to run and we have to go to break, but this is something that Chief Justice Roberts has been fighting against, the Voting Rights Act, mm-hmm. since he was an attorney in the early Republican administrations in the 1970s. This could set up a different kind of battleground for America in the future. There might be part legislative, but it's going to have to be in terms of communities kind of rising up to demand their rights all over again. That happened in the 50s and 60s.
Well, let me tell you what has to happen. Number one, we have to hear from communities that were formerly covered by Section 5. Maryland was not covered by Section 5, but if guests have relatives and friends in other jurisdictions, every state in the South, every state that's a part of the old Confederacy in the South, and as I said, Arizona, Alaska, three boroughs in New York, that we need to hear when voting changes are happening, because Section 5 also let us know. We would find out because of this mechanism that a jurisdiction planned to move a polling place out of the black community, for example. So now we need to hear directly from you, and we've set something up on our website. If you go to www.naacpldf.org, that's www.naacpldf.org, you'll see it says Take Action at some place on our website, and we have an email address, vote@naacpldf.org. Just send us an email telling us what you see in your community, and what's been happening, if there are voting changes that are happening. If there are officials in your community that are talking about their plans to impose certain voting changes, tell us about it. Clip those newspaper articles. Let them talk. But we need all that information. So vote@naacpldf.org. You need to be reaching out to your congressperson. If you haven't called them yet and told them your concerns about the Voting Rights Act, you need to do that now. You know, people like to be, angry about this, and they're talking among themselves.
Right.
But if you haven't called your congressperson, you're part of the problem. Congress needs to move on this and to repair it, and they can do it. I know people talk about the do-nothing Congress. I've just given you the bipartisan numbers. Every time it's been reauthorized, it's been bipartisan, and we've always had contentious issues in Congress. So you need to reach out to your congressperson, and you need to insist. And then finally, everyone needs to rearrange their summer plans and plan to be at the 50th anniversary of the March on Washington.
Amen.
August 24th in Washington, D.C. You can go to Reverend Al Sharpton's National Action Network to find out more about that march. But August 24th, Washington, D.C., you need to be there. There has to be a mass mobilization on this issue.
And let me just say to that as we go to break here, before we thank Cheryl and I for being with us, is that the Center for Emerging Media, which is the organization that produces the Mark Steiner Show and in this community, is on the national board of that march now.
Excellent.
And we'll be doing weekly programs to kind of get people out there, down there, to make voices heard in this country, which has to happen. Sherilyn Ifill, again, from us, congratulations. Even though you've been there for a bit now, President and Director of Counsel of the NAACP Legal Defense and Education Fund. We'll link to all the sites and your tweet on our website. Good to have you with us.
Thanks so much, Mark. Take care.
Take care, Sherilyn.
Bye.
Folks, we'll take a very brief break. I want to remind you on our way to this break, the WEAA. Support for WEA is provided by AAA Mid-Atlantic. More information at AAA.com/discounts. We're going to take a brief break. We're going to go to break with more Ahmad Jamal, Awakening. Stay with us. We'll be right back. And we look at President Barack Obama's trip to Africa.